Well, Michael, let me tell you where I first heard your word. I did not read it in the New Yorker, which I think the chapter from Home at the End of the World appeared in the New Yorker in 1988, according to the material, and I had not read that. However, a couple of months ago, I was listening to the radio, or dial switching, and I think it was National Public Radio, but I'm not certain, and I heard someone read a story about two brothers in Cleveland, and the mother was there, and there was the graveyard sex scene, and it was all very moving, and I thought, who is that? I wonder who that is. But I had to leave, and I couldn't hear the end of it. So I didn't hear the opening of the broadcast and the end of the broadcast, so I didn't know who was speaking until I read A Home at the End of the World, and I found out that it was you reading from your work. And I was absolutely delighted because it all came back, and I knew exactly, I knew the context, and you know, it was like meeting an old friend.
It actually wasn't me. It was a very good actor named James Naughton. Who did a reading for a program called Selected Shorts up at Symphony Space on, on the Upper West Side. And though I would love to take credit for his reading, which was brilliant, it was in fact his voice.
I see. Yeah, I have heard that broadcast. No, but I bet you could read it though. I bet you could read it.
Oh, well. I could. I do. Mm-hmm. Not the way Jim does, but yeah, sure. I'm about to. I'm going on a tour around the country during which I will read and read and read and read and read. And I'm sure by the end of it, I won't even need to refer to the book anymore.
Yes, you will.
Probably.
That's a good thing to do, isn't it? You're a relatively young writer, and this is a way to get certainly a decent amount of exposure.
Oh, well, it's a great thing to do. I think the thing I probably hate the most about writing is the fact that it takes place in such extreme isolation. You do it all by yourself. And then when you're finally done, you essentially put it in a bottle and throw it in the ocean. And I will get letters from people, and some kind, you know, or friends will tell me that they were moved by it, but there's no sense of making any kind of direct contact with people. And so it is a great, it's almost a delirious pleasure to be in a room with live people actually hurling sentences out in their direction.
Yeah, and in a room with people who are interested in your work.
Yeah.
I'm an amateur writer myself, and for about 10 weeks, I took a writer's workshop at the Riverside Writer's Workshop, which was held at the Trinity School in Upper West Side, Manhattan, where I lived, just a couple of blocks from my apartment. And the reason I did it was I write, as you say, in such isolation, and you can't really show it to friends and or relatives. I mean, you could, but they can't make a judgment.
You can't trust them. Yeah. Either way, whether they love it or they hate it, it's just not clean, unbiased criticism. It shouldn't be. You know, I wouldn't want to be intimate with people who are capable of giving me absolutely unbiased feedback. You really need something from people who have no stock in you as anything other than a writer.
Yeah, that's why these 12 people in this room would read my stuff and I would read theirs, and we would go over it sentence by sentence, sometimes word by word, and with complete objectivity. And nobody knew anybody else, so nobody had any reason to do anything but to critique it the way they actually saw it. And that was I don't think I'd want to do it again. You know, it takes time. You have to write material for it. But it was kind of nice to be able to have somebody actually look at my stuff and say whether they like it or not like it, and the reasons for it.
Yeah. That's the kind of input that I think is hardest to get. Feedback that is emotional, because I can't imagine evaluating fiction in any other way, but that also has some kind of body of reasoning behind it. Because, you know, I loved this, I hated that, I thought there should be some cats in it somewhere. It's just nothing you can really use.
Well, I tend not to read critically. I tend to read because I enjoy it. The thing about this writer's workshop, although I did take creative writing when I was going to school, college, although I was a journalism major, I did take creative writing as well. But over the years, I didn't really learn to read critically. I would come to a point in a book where I may not like it Or maybe I did like it, but I didn't really know why. It gave me pleasure, or I felt uncomfortable about it, but I didn't think much about
right,
it.
Right.
A writer's workshop of the type that I took made you actually analyze the material. Why doesn't it work?
Yeah.
Why isn't this character developed? Why is this sentence awkward? Why is it unclear? That was a good thing. Well, I don't want to talk about myself because you have a book here to talk about, and it's just a beautiful, beautiful book. Maybe we ought to preface the discussion about the book by getting some background about yourself. Are you indeed a native of Cleveland?
No. I was born in Cincinnati, though we left there when I was 4 years old, and I still have relatives all over the Midwest, so I go back there, but. No, I actually grew up mostly in California. I chose to set it in Cleveland really because I wanted this place to be sort of mythic. I wanted it to be a real place about which I knew relatively little. So I chose, somewhat arbitrarily, a Midwestern city that I'd only driven through, that I really didn't know intimately.
I would assume you did some research, like at least getting a street map.
Oh, sure. because you have to have pay that respect to the real world, and you know, and Cleveland is a place and people live in it. So sure, but. Oh, it's funny, and this is highly idiosyncratic. I think most writers work in a way that's just the opposite to this. I need to write about places and people that I don't know firsthand all that well. My characters are never taken directly from life, and most of the locations are places that I don't know so intimately because I'm too. Oh, I don't know. I'm too much a combination of sentimentality and meanness when I'm dealing with the actual. And I find that when a character has borrowed too much from my life, I either try to defend that person or to nail that person. And finally, fiction isn't about doing either one of those things. So I really need a fair degree of invention to get as close as I can to the objective truth about the person or place.
So you're saying you do not write autobiographically?
No, I really don't. You know, it would be disingenuous to say, you know, I can't imagine writing any novel that didn't have somewhat a biographical element, because you know, your life and any world you're trying to invent just overlaps by definition. But no, there's no character in this book who is an identifiable person I know. I don't know Cleveland personally. I don't know, a good deal of the book takes place in Phoenix, Arizona, too, which I really don't know intimately. I know passingly, and well enough to get the street names and the flora and the fauna right. But I'm working on a new book, also set in place in New Jersey and Texas, and you know, a number of the many places that I don't know well.
Well, when I read the early scenes in the book, were those the scenes, by the way, that were in the New Yorker magazine excerpt?
The third chapter of the book, appeared in the New Yorker, and then another chapter that actually occurs just about in the middle. But yeah, the first one they takes place in Cleveland. It's involves one of the narrators when he's young, when a tragedy befalls his family.
It had the ring of autobiography, though. You were able to pull that off and make it feel as though this actually took place in real life.
Well, the accident that happens in that chapter, there's a I don't want to spoil the surprise for anybody, but there is a very dreadful, bloody thing that happens to a kid, and that did happen.
Well, I mean, it happens early on enough in the book. I think we can say that the brother runs through a patio window.
Yeah.
And this is not unusual. In fact, My family lives in Texas. Everybody has patios there. And my brother was so frightened that his children were going to run through, he put decals all over the window.
Right, right. Well, that's what this book really is a plea for the use of decals on slightly doors.
I knew this book had a meaning to it.
that's its real purpose. No, when I was a kid in Southern California, I was at a party different from the one in the book. This happens at a party that is this sort almost sort of orgiastic coming together of generations. The kid invites his friends over to his parents' party, and there is this wild kind of meeting of the generations, and everything just looks like, you know, the future just looks like it's going to get better and better and better, and wham, then just their son runs through the glass. I was at a party when I was, I guess, 13. One of those parties that's taking place because somebody's parents are out of town. It was all just kids, and we were drinking beer and carrying on. And there was a slightly older guy who we all knew, who was, you know, every town has a few of these. He was the local hero, the hip local hero, as opposed to the good citizen local hero. There are those two. This guy had a rock band, you know, and was like the first to show up in bell bottoms, and he was the first with everything. He was the coolest. He was the coolest thing we knew. And he was at this party, and we all ran out into the backyard because some younger kids were throwing stones at the house, and we chased them off, went back in, resumed the party, and somehow this guy had stayed outside, and somebody closed the glass door, and he ran through it.
Did he survive it?
No, he didn't.
Oh, my goodness.
You know, we were kids. We were 13. There was nobody in the house except us, except drunken kids. And he was dead. Just it seemed like in a minute.
What a shocking experience. I can see why that would stay with you and might well be something that would be an event in something you would write later.
Oh, and that, though, I changed some of the particulars. That really is the kind of the heart of the book, the heart of the impulse behind the book. The book has gone off in very different directions, but it was that sense of the suddenness with which things can turn. We were 13 and had all the beer we needed and somebody's illicit rumpus room to party in, and you know, everything was great, and wham. There he was, just bleeding on the floor, and that sense of shock and loss is a big part of what got this book started.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the characters. We have two young men, they're friends in high school. They're alike in some ways and radically different in others. Can you sort of tell me about these characters?
Sure. There are two main characters who are men. There are two probably roughly equally main characters who are women. The two men who grow up together are named Jonathan and Bobby. Jonathan is gay and knows pretty much from the start that he is. In my original conception for the book, Bobby was just straight, was strictly heterosexual, and I saw it as a sort of doomed romance between these two men, one of whom was gay, one of whom was straight. And if I'd actually written it just that way, it probably would have been an easier movie sale. But in the writing, I found that just as these characters took on life, Bobby's sexuality became more ambiguous. And he is still, at heart, a straight man. But the way the book ended up almost writing itself, Bobby became not just the object of Jonathan's frustrated passion, but the link between Jonathan and this woman, Claire, who is in love with Jonathan, who wants to have a baby with him. And so they form this triangle. It becomes essentially a marriage between three people. Jonathan's gay, Claire is straight, and Bobby is somewhere in between.
Well, you said Bobby's sexuality is ambiguous. That may be true. However, I have a feeling that Bobby's brief sexual experimentation with Jonathan at the beginning of the book may be attributed to adolescent exploration.
Oh yeah. I don't think of Bobby as gay, and I don't think of him as you know, gay but repressed. I do think he's sort of Bobby to me is almost like a veteran of a war, that he's kind of suffering from shell shock.
Well, he lost his family.
His family. Yeah, after the death of his brother and then the deaths of his parents, he's there's something that's been sort of wiped out in him that he never quite fully recovers. There's a kind of an absence in him that both Claire and Jonathan, each in his or her own way, sort of inhabits. I think that's more. It's not so much a question whether Bobby is gay or straight as it is whether he's kind of sexually present or absent. He's essentially absent. He's essentially somebody you can have any kind of fantasy you want about.
Now there's a fourth character too, who is Jonathan's lover in New York. Tell me about him.
Eric is this man with whom Jonathan has a strictly sexual relationship while he's living in New York, and about whom Jonathan doesn't think very much one way or the other. It's pure sex, and it goes on for quite some time. And when Claire and Jonathan and Bobby all have a baby and move to the country together, Eric, this kind of peripheral person who Jonathan thought he could just use, you know, mutually, it was kind of one of those mutual use relationships that Jonathan thought he could just kind of have and then move on from, turns up, and he has AIDS, and they take him in. They've got a house. They've got this odd sort of rickety, vaguely New Age family, which isn't working out the way for many of the same reasons that more traditional families often don't work out. And I think finally this really is giving away the ending. But the purpose of all this, what they've all made that was worth doing, was to have a place for this stranger, this person nobody really knows and nobody has ever deeply cared about, to come to die when no one else will have him.
Well, I'm not going to give away the ending, of course, but this is one of the advantages to having the author sitting next to you and talking. I was puzzled a little bit about Claire's motivation for leaving at the end. Maybe you could tell me about that.
Oh, I think Claire has always had one foot. Claire always had one foot out the door, right from the start. I think part of the reason she was in love with Jonathan, the gay character, was that she finally doesn't really want to be committed to a man. You know, she wanted to have a baby, and really, truly, she wanted to do it on her own, but she couldn't quite approach it as cold-heartedly as that. And I think though she tells herself a slightly different story, I think finally she has the baby, she pays the boys off by buying this house for them, by giving them a place, a kind of destination, which they've always felt they lacked. And then she goes. She takes the baby and goes.
Also, they're obviously, although it's not directly expressed, I would imagine there's something unusual and potentially stressful in that sort of triangle relationship.
Sure.
It's not.
Sure.
It's not what most people do.
No. Not most people. Some people, but not. You wouldn't really say the majority have three-way marriages. No, and I think part of what they're all three of them are surprised to find is that there are certain sort of inescapable domestic conflicts that are just human, that are just part of trying to have a life, and part of our sort of mingled desire to love and murder each other, and you know, the new experimental family finally isn't more of a shelter, doesn't work out better than the old kind of flawed tried and true method does.
And in fact, none of those hippie communes of the 1960s and early 1970s succeeded.
No.
None of them are all gone.
No,
or if there are any left, we don't know anything about them.
Yeah.
Well, when you had written some of the early chapters that you had sent to the New Yorker, the book had not been finished. The book was still forming
right.
and developing.
Right.
So you didn't really know where your characters were going to be going at that time, did you?
No, I didn't. No. Though there was, by the time I got around to sending that first chapter to the New Yorker, there was a lot more of, that wasn't all my work to date. There was a lot more of the book that had been written, and I was rewriting and re-rewriting. But no, I didn't know how it was going to end. And in fact, I had a terrible time ending it. I'm still not sure if it ends exactly correctly. But it's too late now. But you know, after the chapter came out in the New Yorker, when publishers started calling my agent to see if there was a novel, only Farrar, Straus, and Giroux, the people who did end up publishing it, said, "We'll take it on the basis of this chapter. We trust this writer enough to stand by him and to commit to buying whatever book he thinks he wants to write."
That sounds both flattering and terrifying.
It was exactly both, but I'll always love them for doing that. And you know, if there are ever wars between publishing houses and we have to choose up sides, I will definitely fight with Farrar Straus, because other people wanted to see the manuscript and wanted to see if what I was doing sort of matched their idea about what they wanted to publish and what they thought they could sell. You know, and when the finished manuscript went out to a few people, there were some other people who were interested, and some people said, "Oh, God, we didn't know you were writing this."
Yeah, they have their own ideas. Editors have their own ideas, their own imagination, their own perceptions about what they want in a book, and it may not be the writer's.
Yeah, and I think FSG is somewhat unique, and I'm sorry it's so unique in its willingness to trust writers and to publish something even if it isn't perfect, even if it may not sell a million copies. I mean, I think that's a sentiment that's pretty much dying out, and I think some good risky books aren't getting published.
Absolutely. Absolutely, there is a prejudice against what publishers call mid-list books, and they seem to do it with such disdain. Mm-hmm. They really are interested. For example, I was shocked and outraged when I saw that I believe it was Simon and Schuster had agreed to pay Ivana Trump $5 million for three paperbacks or three books, and then they were going to find a writer for those books. I mean, what? Look, I wish him well. If the book can earn back more than $5 million, maybe they can use some of that money to publish good books. Maybe.
That's the rationale. If there was somebody from Simon & Schuster here, I suspect that's...
It is Simon & Schuster, isn't it? I think it...
Probably, yeah. Yeah, I don't know for
sounds
a fact.
Sounds like Simon & Schuster. However, Simon & Schuster does publish a few good literary books.
Oh, sure.
So they do have them on their list.
I don't know of any major publisher that doesn't publish a few good literary books, at least. But it seems like the pie is being cut very differently now than it was, say, 10 years ago. Because I don't finally believe the one about how when they make their $1 billion from Ivana Trump's books, you know, they can publish more obscure experimental novels with the money. I think they're taking the money that they would have paid for mid-list books, giving it to Ivana Trump, and when they make their $1 billion from her book, they're going to buy the next Ivana Trump's books.
I think you may be right. This is not your first novel, is it?
No, this is my second novel.
Tell me about your first one and how that came about.
My first one is sort of like a deformed baby who's lived in the attic all its life.
What was it called?
It was called Golden States. Came out in 1984, and I wrote it in a very short time in a sort of panic because... you know, I was getting older. I kept saying I was a writer, and I kept not producing anything. And I thought, I could suddenly. It was one of those. I suppose this is the start of one's middle age, and you know, it can happen to you when you're 40. It can happen to you when you're 23. You know, I suddenly realized that I was on my way to a fate. I was making a future for myself, and. You know, tending bar and saying someday I was going to write a novel was something I could really keep doing well into my dotage. And I sat down over a summer in a friend's extra room and banged this book out. And it was published.
Who was the publisher?
The publisher was Crown.
I don't know why you would characterize this book as being like a deformed baby. I mean, it was obviously a legitimate effort because you had
sure,
a legitimate
oh,
publisher.
Sure. Actually, it's not the fact that the baby is deformed that's the key here. It's the fact that it's been kept in the attic all its life. And the people at Crown were great. My editor there, who has gone on to be the publisher at Scribner's, put a great deal into the book, and I don't want to kind of discount her belief in it. I just found as I was working on it, and certainly after it came out, that I couldn't shake the fact that I'd written it too fast. It wasn't a bad book, and it got good reviews. But I knew how much better it could have been. And I just felt like there are so many extraneous demands on our attention. Part of what makes it so hard to live in the world is the fact that everybody is tugging on your sleeve, trying to tell you some kind of nonsense that's going to lodge in your head and take up space that could be better used. And I just don't think there's any need for another pretty good book. It was all right. I really felt like there were other books people should read instead. So, I turned down the paperback offer.
I'd like to explore that for a moment. I've heard this said before that there are too many books in the world. Too many books have been written, and not enough of them have been read. And maybe we ought to have a moratorium on publishing any more books. And that's really silly when you think about it. One, to have a moratorium on any more books would deprive all of us in the future of being able to fulfill a creative urge. Two, your book was published in 1984, and it said something about you, and it said something about the 1980s in a way that if there had been a moratorium on books in, say, 1980, we wouldn't know about. Mm-hmm. So there's always a need. We can't stop, and we can't stop the creative impulse, and we can have to continually write about ourselves and our world.
Oh, of course not. And, you know, as a novelist, I'm certainly not very likely to support any kind of contention that it's time to stop writing novels. What I said was there are too many pretty good books in the world. There are too many books that somebody whomps out that are made of sentences that somebody has plunked down like so many shovelfuls of concrete, gotten to the last sentence of, and said, fine, this baby goes out, next book. I would certainly never put myself in any kind of censoring position, certainly not involving anybody else's book, but if you've read a book that you weren't especially moved by, somebody says to you, should I read that? You tell them, no, I'll read something else. And that was what I felt I was doing with my first novel. I learned a lot from writing it. And by turning down the paperback deal, by kind of letting that book go, I felt like I was saying, you know, read something else. Read my next book.
Yeah, I'm going to put this behind me and go on to better things.
Yeah.
Well, tell me a little bit about your childhood and what impulses you might have had that led you toward a writing career.
Oh, that's always a hard one.
Well, you don't have to answer.
I don't mind answering. I'm just not sure how satisfying the answer will be, because my childhood was just about as gothic and as ordinary as the childhood of most people who are white and are born into comfortable circumstances. You know, it was on one hand absolutely insane and surreal, and on the other hand very comfortable and pretty much without incident. And why that kid growing up in that white house over on that block grew up wanting to be a novelist, and the one, you know, the one next door went into securities is a little bit mysterious to me. As long as I remember, certainly as long as I could read, I've read books and felt like I can do that. And I think finally what it gets down to is an impulse just about as base as that. It's like sitting at an opera and hearing the singing and thinking, I can get up there and do that. I can sing like that. I've always wanted to do it because I felt like I could.
Did you grow up in a literary household at all?
Not especially. I mean, my parents read. It's not.
What did your father do?
Bankrupt, bookless houses that people grow up in. My father's in advertising, mm-hmm. but the account end, the business, mm-hmm. the business aspect.
You grew up in Los Angeles.
Yeah.
Where did you go to school?
Stanford.
That is a great creative writing.
Well, that's really where I started. Uh-huh. Where I started to formally study. It was something I always thought I would do, though I hadn't really quite imagined that I would try to write something with some structure that I would try to get somebody to publish. I started studying writing there, and that's what really got me.
You also studied at Iowa, didn't you?
I
read in one of the publicity pieces.
Yeah, after, it was, Stanford was great for writing, but in some other ways it was sort of an awful place, at least as far as I was concerned. By the time I graduated, I had really had it up to my eyebrows with ambition, with people's desire to be another corporate lawyer and another research scientist who doesn't think about what the research is going to be used for. And all I wanted to do was distance myself from all that. That's when I began my career as a mixologist. Bartending job.
You got a bartending job. Well, isn't it true that most bartenders have always expressed a desire to finish their novels?
A lot of them. That's what drove me to write my first novels. I felt myself turning into one of those.
Where did you tend bar?
Oh, let's see, in San Francisco, Laguna Beach, Colorado. I went all over the place.
You make a good martini?
I make a wicked martini. And, you know, I finally, after I'd done that for a few years, it's hard. It's hard to hold on to an idea like writing a novel or even writing stories. You know, when you live down the block from a shopping mall and you don't know anybody who's a writer, you don't even know very many people who read. I kind of got myself off into this world in which trying to be a writer just didn't make much sense. It seemed like this cultivated eccentricity. It sounded like I, you know, telling people what I was trying to do was sort of like telling them, you know, I've decided to crochet toaster cozies, and that's going to be my career. That's what I'm, you know, I want to crochet the perfect toaster cozy before. Come to the beach.
I know exactly what you're talking about. In my high school yearbook in the 1950s, it says ambition, writer. I didn't really know what that meant exactly. I mean, I knew that I wanted a creative element to it, but I didn't know exactly how to implement it. So when I went to college, I studied journalism. And I got my first job after college. My father was a very successful businessman. And I got a job in a radio and television station in Huntington, West Virginia, my first full-time job. I was so pleased. And I talked to my father. I said, I get to work the midnight shift. I have an all-night show. My father said, midnight shift? He says, that sounds unnatural to me. And I began to think, I mean, I've always remembered his saying that to me. And I began to think that, you know, what I did has always been unnatural to most people.
Yeah.
You know, I don't work, I work on weekends, I work at nights, I interview strange people like writers. it's so strange because it's not like, your father was an advertising man, and I'm sure there was a degree of conformity in his life because of the nature of that sort of work, and it's not that way with most journalists and most writers.
Yeah.
So I know exactly what you're saying.
Yeah, and I think it's hard to get started. Once, if you're successful, then people are fine about it. Then suddenly, you know, then you're a writer. Oh, you're a journalist. Great. Oh, you know, you interview crazy people on this radio station. Wonderful. But you know, when you have nothing to show yet, when it's just an aspiration, and you're kind of shut up in your room typing.
Well, I have bad news for you, Michael. Next time you're on TWA, you're flying to the West Coast, and you're sitting next to somebody who says, what do you do? And you say, I'm a writer. I published a book. He said, the guy's going to say, have I read it? And so I don't know. The guy's going to say, what's the name of it? And you're going to say, A Home at the End of the World. And the guy's going to look at you blankly shrug and order a drink from the stewardess. And
well, I'm not quite as naive and delicate as that. I think what the really important change that happens is that with some time, when you start to develop a body of work, and you know, maybe somebody's actually published some of it, you start to think of yourself as a writer. And if some asshole on a plane doesn't get it, fine. But when you're just starting, when you're uncertain about it yourself, I think it's hard to get a toehold in it. It's hard to feel enough conviction to keep at it while people you knew in college are going to graduate school and then getting jobs and starting to earn money, and you know, there you are.
How will I know? It never occurred to me that going into broadcasting is not profitable for the vast majority of us. talking about, a few anchor people who make some money, television anchor people. The vast majority of us make a middle income and work very hard and work on holidays and weekends. And it's, but nobody told me that. You know, I only did it because I thought that's something I would like to do. But if I really had some career conceptions as a young man, as a post-adolescent in college, I probably would have gone into banking, maybe. I don't know. But, you know, there's no stability there either. I know the Citibank is laying off thousands of people, and well, I don't know what you do. Somehow you fall. You know,
you're having a justification these days.
But you fall into things, don't you? Really, in the long run, you kind of it's kind of an accident.
Sure. Oh, it's absolutely an accident. I think I'm so grateful that I could not, at the age of 21, have seen my future at 30. Because I think, you know, my fantasies were so grandiose, and I imagined myself at 30, I imagined myself celebrated, you know, fatted, you know, starting on my fifth novel. And if I had been able to see that at 30, I'd have, you know, one obscure book, no money, I'd still be looking for a job, I'd still be uncertain about whether or not I was doing the right thing with my life. I think I would have stopped right there. I think I would have gone to law school, and it would have been a mistake. I'm glad I kept doing it. But you need, it really helps to have the kind of delusions that you have when you're 19, 20, 21.
Oh, I still have them. Besides that, you develop at your own pace. You know, it is startling to see some writers who have published books when they're very, very young. Gore Vidal and Norman Mailer and a few people like that, and their Styron when they were in their early 20s, and they published these sensational literary novels. And then they go on to publish novel after novel, and they become celebrated. Most people can't do that. I mean, it's so you go at your own pace, and you will do. I mean, you have the talent; you can. That's readily available. You go at your own pace, and you will develop, as you said, a body of work over a period of years, and you'll do it at your own rate. And you don't need somebody nipping at your tails, and saying, hey, you should have gone to law school. My mother kept saying I should have gone to graduate school. You know, I didn't do it. I just had to get out to the workplace and do all the stuff that I did.
Right.
But you just do what you can do. Now, I was talking to Harry Cruz. I don't know if you've read any of his books, but he's a wonderful novelist.
Yeah.
He goes to the gym and he works out. His legs are bad because he's fallen off his motorcycle a lot. And he says, I take to the gym what I have to take to the gym, which is not a lot, but I try. And he says, that's the same thing I do when I write a novel. I take to the novel what I have to give to it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I don't think anybody can ask anybody else more than that, do you?
No. I think that puts it really well. But I also think writing a book, any book that's worth reading, requires a really peculiar mix of humility and wild egotism, and I think somebody like Mailer or Styron, you know, they were certainly precocious in their ability to put together sentences. I think more than anything, they were precocious in their conviction at that age that they could do it, coupled with the kind of absence of vanity that any really good novelist has, however self-promoting, however boastful and bloated they may be in public. You finally have to feel sort of small in the face of your subject. And I think that's something most people don't have when they're very young. That's why I think it's a fluke for somebody that age, for somebody 23 to write. I don't know, how old was Mailer when he wrote The Naked and the Dead?
Oh, he was in his early 20s. 24?
Yeah.
24, 25, something like that.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's amazing for somebody that age to have developed the sense of himself in the world that he would need to have to write a book like that. I feel like I spent 10 years out of college just sort of developing that, getting over my this sense of myself as I'm just getting all tangled up.
Well, I think it boils down to what I said before. You develop at your own rate of speed, your own pace, and you take to your work what you have to take to it. And, Michael, if the literary career doesn't work out, you can always go back to bartending.
I still make a wicked one.
That would be kind of fun, though, really, wouldn't it? As long as you don't drink yourself, it would seem to be kind of interesting to talk to people and... I don't know.
Oh, it was a good job. I liked it for a long time. And then, you know, you finally reach a point where, seeing people getting drunk, you're really not seeing them in their most flattering light. And, hey, I get drunk. Most people I hang around with get drunk. But this is every single day for hours. And
you probably lose interest in the people after a while.
You start to lose respect for them. And I found myself starting to walk down city streets thinking, looking at people thinking, you look all right now, but I know after a couple of drinks that you are just a big fool. And we're all big fools, but it wasn't something I wanted to know about people all the time. It wasn't a sense of humanity that I wanted delivered and redelivered and re-redelivered every day. So that is what I don't miss about it. But I'm available for guest bartending spots.
Well, I would also imagine there's a degree of pressure. I mean, how many personal telephone calls can you make while you're bartending, and do you have time to scribble any words down while you're bartending? I think unless there are a lot of lulls, you're probably pretty busy if you're.
You're busy. Well, sure, but that's great. I love being busy. You know, one of the great things about a job like that is it happens at night, so you've done your writing for the day, and then it's like a performance. That was the fun part. It's like being in a play every night, except the script changes every night. No, I mean it's a great job for an egomaniac. Really, only egomaniacs need apply. because you're right out there and you're talking to people and you're kind of running the show.
Well, Michael Cunningham, it was great talking to you. I love this book. It's a moving book and beautifully written. The Home at the End of the World. Thank you very, very much.
Thank you.